The Last Bohemians LA. Unexpected stories from Maverick Women.
Yes, this episode of The Last Bohemians LA, supported by Audio Technica, is with an actual Bond girl. She made film history when she snogged 007 in 1973's Live and Let Die, becoming Bond's first black love interest. She took on edgy roles in what were known as the blaxploitation films of the 1970s, with titles like Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. And she was also a Playboy bunny in 1960s New York, and later a Playboy model, as the civil rights movement was bubbling up around her. She can still do an athletic move called the bunny dip, but more on that later. I'm talking about Gloria Hendry. She is a total trailblazer, and perhaps an under-celebrated one, whose life story takes us from a broken home in New Jersey to the glitzy casinos of New York via a fated film audition with Roger Moore in New Orleans. She's written about that and much more in her recent memoir, Gloria, which is filled with incredible photographs of her in her youth, with abs to die for, looking strong and self-assured and topless. Before you meet Gloria in a rather noisy hotel in downtown LA, sorry about that, I just want to shout out the Last Bohemians LA sponsors, Audio Technica. Audio Technica is a Japanese-born company who are at the forefront of home podcasting gear. I've been using their stuff to make The Last Bohemians for the past two seasons, and you really can't beat it for quality. I do mean that. Discover their products at audio-technica.com or at audiotechnica_EU if you're on Instagram. And just to flag, this episode contains themes of abuse and suicide towards the beginning, which some listeners may find triggering. The thing of what we're doing is called The Last Bohemians. It's a celebration of maverick women who've lived a life outside the norm.
I wasn't that little girl that stand on the sideline. Ain't he cute? Oh, really? I wasn't one of them. Still not. I hung out with the guys. No, honey. I didn't want to be married either. I didn't think of guys. That wasn't my trip at all. Didn't want to be tied down to any man. Changed my name, never. Still use my name, my credit, my everything, my money. I could have married very wealthy, but I refused to be that second woman to stand on the side and put up with and be homebodied. There's just no way. That lifestyle does not appeal to me. When I graduated high school, I had planned to get the hell out of there. I didn't like the food. I didn't like the man my mother was living with. He would beat her up. He was an alcoholic, meaning the kind of alcoholic, if you drank one drink, you were drunk. And he was a whole different person. He used to beat her up, and I tried to kill him one day. I didn't know it. All I knew is that I was sleepwalking with a knife in my hand and going to the bedroom to, you know, I hated him. I dearly hated him. It's watching my mother go through all those changes, and she was also a factory worker. She worked. He worked. They were the only ones in the community that had a car where I lived in Newark, New Jersey, which was at that time not a good place to be from. All I knew was I had to get the hell out of this community, and I knew, first of all, I had to get the hell out of this house. I wanted to make it, period. I lived in an ethnic community, and it didn't seem to be any way out. People getting beaten up. Gangs, the white, the Italianos would come over to our section and fight. We would go to over their section and fight. It was a real racial situation that was just, you can touch it, you know, with your hands. The oppression that I felt as though if this was life, I went out of here. We lived on the fifth floor, was a walk up. And I said to Mom, I said, Ma, I got to get out of here. I said, give me $250 so I can move. I need to go to New York. She said, I don't have it. My mother knew how to make a dollar grin. I'm telling you, that lady squeezed that money. I said, I can't wait. I'm going to get a job. Well, girl, I didn't have the money to move to New York. I threw up the window and sat on the windowsill. I didn't know what I was about to do. All I knew was I had to get out of here.
So you escaped.
Well, I almost jumped off the fifth floor out of that window.
What held you back?
My mother said, Gloria, because she saw me. She said, I have it. And she gave it to me. And that's how I got out of there.
A woman of extremes, Gloria.
Yeah, isn't that something? I went to Essex College of Business for Law as a legal secretary. Because I told my counselor when I was in grade school, he said, what do you want to be? I said, an attorney. He said, be realistic. You can be a secretary. So I took him at his word. I could be a legal secretary. But I did want to be an attorney. But remember, he was Caucasian, and the oppression, and the racial situation, not only that, against women, period. There weren't many women attorneys at that time. And even women doctors, you probably can count them. Thank goodness for today. Woo! I got that job.
You were working as a legal secretary in the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So you were working at the coalface of civil rights.
Yes.
And so was that when Martin Luther was killed, when you were working in that office?
Yes. When I was working with Roy Wilkins, he was the attorney for the de facto segregation of the Board of Education. And it was a small office with Roy Wilkins and Robert Banks and Barbara Morrison, a female attorney. We all were people of color. Everybody wore suits. When Martin Luther King was killed, I felt as though the world was doomed. I felt as though that was really my president. And that color distinction was just so strong. And it stopped you from even moving into communities. It stopped you from getting a loan. It stopped you from even educating yourself. The bomb scares we got seemed like it was every single day. And of course, with fear, everything is bigger and more suffering. I suffered. We suffered. And when he was killed, I never forget. I walked out of that office. People were talking about him in the news. I just cried, and I walked down the street and cried and cried and cried. I said, I can't take it anymore. I want beauty in my life.
So you wanted beauty, and you went from wearing one kind of suit to a different kind of suit. What suit was that?
The bunny suit, and it was shocking. I went to the Playboy Club on 59th Street between 5th and Madison, and I met Chinky Grimes, the bunny mother. She dressed us, and she was a cotton club dancer in her days. She was wonderful. She was a lot of fun, and she was one of the, I think, the chorus girls in the cotton club days in Harlem, and she said, how soon can you start? And I said, I have to give 2 weeks' notice.
So what was that like?
Well, when they put the suit on you, they have to put their hands between your legs and bring the suit up between your legs and, you know, fit it according to your shape because it's a V-shape. I was like, oh, don't do that. Oh, you know, she said, girl, stand still. I'm not going to hurt you. It was like a corset, a full corset that clenched in your waistline and also pushed up your boobs. I don't have much. That's why I was shocked I was even hired. She said, girl, we just put a sock in there. She picked up my breast and she stuck that sock underneath there, honey. And she pushed it over and she pushed the other one over. And there you have it. I had a crease. And she zipped you up. Suck in, will you? Will you suck in? And up it went because we all had to help each other. All of us in the same locker at the club. Help each other and zip our costume up.
And what was your job there?
We were waitresses in 3-inch heels. Today is 6 inches. And we were trained by Hugh Hefner's brother. He trained us to be able to know our drinks, our martinis, our frappes, our whiskeys, our wines, and etc., and how to sit it on your tray with bottles of soda and a tray of food. Girl, we got strong. I can handle probably 10 bottles on my fingers, 6 plates up top, and walk around and serve with the bunny dip. And the bunny dip, that's the only way you could serve, because if you serve forward, your breast might fall out.
And you can still do it.
I could still do it. I was surprised just then, too. I could still do it.
How empowered did you feel as a Playboy bunny?
You know, I have to say, the club protected us. The room directors, if we had any problems with any of the customers, because the customers were always fascinated with us, and the men would want to grab our bunny tail, that cottony tail, or wanna say some fresh stuff to us, or touch us. And we tell them, don't do that. We tell the room director, he comes over, he would ask for their Playboy Club card and take it. Say, get out.
Was it financially empowering working there?
Oh, yeah. I made between $1,000 to $2,000 a week of 4 days' work, cash, in the 60s.
Wow.
From $200 a week? Come on. When I read that in the papers, I said, I got to go work here. I was about the money, especially in those days. I've never had the opportunity to have the money I had, which definitely liberated me. I didn't have to worry about paying my bills. I could fly to wherever I wanted to go to. I can go to buy a couple of $100 pair of shoes. In those days, in the 60s, a couple of hundred pair of shoes today is $3,000. You know, I still have my Gucci boots that I paid $300 for. I still have those boots made out of chinchilla. So I'm saying I've never been so liberated. Once you begin to have the money to go wherever you needed to go and do the things you wanted to do, I mean, that freedom is so great. And I've had that in and out of my life periodically.
How many women of color were bunnies at the time?
There was Catherine Lee Scott, myself. We had about 150 girls from all walks of life with all various languages. Oh, God. It was an experience that helped me stop being shy and scared of white people.
I saw the picture of your Playboy Bunny reunion on Instagram. When you get together, what stories do you tell?
We talk about yesterday. We talk about going out and partying in the limousines, picking us up and making us feel special. There are a couple of other things that happens, like going into the back room of a restaurant where they have a illegal gambling casino going on back in those days. And when we walk in, oh, the bunnies are here. Or being invited out. And first of all, to be in a limousine from where I'm coming from, no way. I was living on another level culturally. And I got the opportunity later on as an actress to travel and hang out with dukes and duchesses and princesses and all that in Europe. I got that opportunity to land on top of hotels and had the entire penthouse. I mean, I have to say that getting out of your community is very important to the broadening of your life.
What was this new wave of cinema that was coming out in the 70s that you got involved with?
They call today black exploitation. I call it the Black Renaissance. The studios were really going under. People weren't attending movies like they used to. So whatever the reasons, all of a sudden this new thing comes in with all these people of color and also with martial arts. And stories from their point of view, and because of Ron O'Neill's Superfly, talking about today's color situation, how oppressed these people are, and how they are fighting back. And all of a sudden, it became worldwide. This was like the people were passing around the film from one movie theater to the next before you know it, boom. And then the studios get whiffed of it. Hey, you know, hey, this is what they're doing. Hey, we got to get in on this. Save them. The studios were saved by our films, which they call black exploitation.
Because black exploitation or blaxploitation has negative connotations.
Very negative. Drugs, alcohol, prostitution, pimps. I wasn't drawn to it. It was drawn to me. I happened to be in New York City at the time, and a wonderful friend of mine, Ken Menard, he stood in for Sidney Poitier. And I had done a movie with Sidney Poitier called For Love of Ivy in the 60s and with Abby Lincoln. And he said, you ought to go to California. He said, because the movie industry is really popping there. And I said, okay. So I contacted an agent in California and he said, yeah, I'll meet up with you. And I flew, of course, and I went to his office and he said, I'd like to take you to the set. I said, what's that? He said, Larry Cohen, he's filming in his home, in his mansion on Coldwater Canyon. And I went there, and here we are. I'm looking at Larry Cohen. He directed and wrote Black Caesar, and Fred Williamson, who stars in it. And we all met, and he said, hey, we hired you. He said, how do you feel about nudity? I said, I'm fine. I'm a Playboy bunny. I said, as long as it's done with taste, and the set is private. Make sure he wears a sock. He said, fine. And that was it. That was my first co-starring role.
What was your attitude like to nude scenes? I know that you said that you felt comfortable nude as a Playboy bunny. Did it feel like you were breaking taboos?
No. How do you know you're breaking taboos? I didn't think that much about it. I really didn't. But I did know one thing, that we were making ground on making our stars 110th Street. Matter of fact, that was during the time of, I think it was probably around the time of For Love of Ivy. That was with Antonio Francioso, Antonio Farkas. But it was very, very powerful and very, very realistic. It took place in Harlem. I was the girlfriend of Antonio Farkas.
And what sort of things did you have to do in the film?
Well, it was a threesome.
And what did you think when you read the script?
I'm an artist. That's first and foremost. You know, maybe Sidney Poitier would say to me, don't do that. Because it showed the dregs of our society. So I was having a tough time working. And having a tough time working, you will do things that you don't really want to do, but then you have a level. I'm not doing porn. That's out. So I had to bring something of a quality to it, the best I could. But I'm not going porn. And I know some of my artists went porn because it was easier to work. So it got down to wanting to work, you know. So I said, okay, I'll do this. But it wound up being one of a classic movie. Cross 110th Street was rated very highly. It was a wonderful experience, but I'll tell you, we slept on floors between sets. We never went home. We shot, I think, maybe 2 weeks. It was nothing like Live and Let Die when I did the Bond. Everything was immaculate. Everything was first class. Not at all. It was an experience. Very raw. I did all my stunts.
Looking back at old photographs of you from the 70s, you look incredibly powerful yourself. You're strong and muscular and lean. Where did your body confidence come from?
Sports. I was into what they want to call bodybuilding. That wasn't what I was doing. I was just being athletic, just being who I am. I'm an amateur athlete. I ski, I swim, I run, I climb stairs, dance, ballet, modern, tennis, ping pong, horseback. I mean, I've done all those things. Back in the day, a guy would stand there and say to me, I wouldn't want a woman with all the muscles, you know. I said, oh, you want a Barbie. They would tell me, I wouldn't date a woman with all those muscles. Because especially back in those days, I was like this. My thighs were like a high C. I was, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can outdo them, too. Now I can outclimb them, outrun them. I don't think it's so much as being physically tough, but being in shape to deal with whatever you had to deal with. Yeah. If I had to run, if we have an earthquake, I can go down the stairs. I'm on the 70th floor, I can make it. If I had to go up a hill, I can make it. Being able to ride a bike, I can ride a bike for miles. Being in shape to be able to take on what life has to do.
How do you stay in shape now, Gloria? Because you're very sprightly, lots of energy.
Thank you so much. I still run, jog, I skip rope, I lift weights. I don't ride horses anymore.
How did you end up being a Bond girl, Gloria?
I got a phone call from Lloyd Komar, my manager in New York. He said they wanted to see you, and I was in California. Because when I flew into California, my first job was Black Caesar. And then I got another movie with Bernie Casey, and I was supposed to start with that. But in the meantime, Lloyd Komar had called me. He said, they want to see you for the Bond movie. So I said, I have to fly back to New York. He said, yes. I said, who's paying for it? You are. I couldn't believe it. So I said, okay, let me crunch some numbers. So anyway, I wound up going back to New York. I still had my New York apartment, which, thank God, at that time, I was doing all right. So I went and I saw Harry Saltzman. I went to his office and he stood up with these wonderful dark eyes and handsome man. And he said, how was your trip, madam? I said, fine. And I sat down. He said, how soon can you get ready to go to New Orleans? Almost immediately. And I was like, and I would like you to meet Roger Moore and I'd like you to meet Guy Hamilton. I said, okay.
On the plane, off you went.
I got first class. He flew me first class, darling. I said, oh my God, first class. So when I got to New Orleans, they picked me up again, a limousine. Wow. And they took me to the French Quarter, and soon came down Roger Moore. Now, the saint, that's what I remember him as. And we sat and we talked and broke bread. How would you like to go to the set? Which I did. And I said, if you'd like to stay the weekend, you know, would you like to stay over? And I said, no. You know why.
Why?
Don't want to be caught up in no couch situation. Don't want any possibility of that happening.
Did your co-stars previously try on with you?
That's the end thing anyway. If you get into the world of this creative, wonderful world, I mean, as a female, especially back then, and even today, you have to know you don't cross the line past 11 o'clock at night at a party, and also to spend the night overnight with a bunch of men. I mean, you crazy? Are you kidding me? That's the worst thing you can do, is to make it with your leading man, first of all. You know, you can't give it away right away. You can do it undertow on the scene, on the set, and when it's over, if you want to get together, do. Keep that as your power base, if you can. It's bad enough that we still are not being paid the same. And also, it's bad enough that they doubt you do what you do because you're a woman. You always have to prove it more so. And my hue, they doubt I can do what I can do because of my hue, and then because I'm a woman. So that's how I think.
That's great advice. How do you look back at your Bond appearance? How do you look back at your character, Rosie?
Well, when I got the script, excuse me, everybody, I said, what the hell am I going to do with this crap? She was such a ditz. I yearned to have a strong, opinionated and a strong part where it means something of substance from the get-up. But this character, she was so wishy-washy. She was a double agent, and she almost didn't know what the hell she was doing. She did dumb things, you know? So I really had to, I read that script. I read my scene probably 20, 30, 40 times, you know, to get something in there. Besides me coming in and from the side of, I can't stand this girl.
But the character did break new ground in terms of the Bond franchise.
I had no idea, because I didn't go to a Bond movie to see even their first one. I never saw a Bond movie before that.
At the time when the film came out, how unusual was it to see an interracial relationship on screen at that moment in 1973?
I was a bunny. My friends were from every walk of life, languages, and etc. I thought nothing of it, absolutely nothing of it. And as a matter of fact, working with Roger, thought nothing of it. As I'm lying on top of him at the, where the water is running, where we've at the lake, I blew in his face garlic. I ate it the night before on purpose. We played games with each other. And I was like, ah, he went, you lucky my wife's Italian. We were wobbling around having so much fun. But I do know that there was a standoffishness about it. When I kissed Roger, that I was a romantic interest of a Bond. And it's like, please, you know, you turn the lights out, we're all the same. As a matter of fact, Ian Fleming wrote the role of Solitaire to be a woman of color. And it was that. Jane Seymour and I were brought in later because they changed their mind.
And what did you think of that?
They kept apologizing to me. Gloria, we apologize. It was like, why are you apologizing to me? Finally, I got the skinny. I was like, oh my God. You mean to tell me the role that I'm playing, Rosie Carvey, was supposed to be Caucasian and Solitaire was supposed to be a woman of color? Yes. If you read the book, it tells you distinctly Solitaire is a woman of color.
It just seems a bit strange that they swapped it.
Well, because I guess, you know, stop it, Gloria. I can't think for them. Something went down to make them switch it. Probably their fan base.
What happened after Bond came out? Because in your memoir, there's something about your name being disassociated from the film.
Yeah, after a while, I didn't see anything, you know. My name wasn't even mentioned, you know, or when they gave an event. Nobody called me with all the Bond ladies together. I didn't get a call, etc. I was told that my film in Africa They had a riot there in Africa, and I don't know what region it was, but they had a riot there when the movie, you know, black and white kissing on the set. And in certain parts of the country in America, they blacked out my scene. It wasn't shown.
But how did that feel to be sidelined like that?
A woman of color, you can expect almost anything to be rejected. My middle name is rejection. I'm used to it. That's unfortunate. And it's unfortunate because most of the time I look for it. And I say, bring it on. That gives me more fuel to keep going. Because if I took rejection the way it's supposed to be taken, I'd be crying, and I've done that. I've cried and say, why? What's wrong? What have I done? And I'm tired of blaming myself. I'm tired of going back and forth that way and trying to think for people. So I've stopped trying to figure it out because it's none of my business. My motto is, it doesn't matter what you think of me because I can't do anything about it. Around 75, everything stopped.
You were a Bond girl. How could you not get another film part?
There are also other Bond ladies that couldn't get any more work for whatever the reasons are. I don't know what happened back in the 70s. I thought I had arrived. I thought I was already up there. And I was getting phone calls from all kinds of organizations to appear, as well as guest star spots on television. I mean, they were calling me directly. I wasn't auditioning. I thought I had arrived. And I say it again. I thought I had arrived. And nobody told me, get off your haunches, girl. And this is when you dig in to do what you do. I didn't know. But at one point I was guest starring on this show and that show and this show. All of a sudden when things stopped and I ran out of money, and when my last film I think was Bare Knuckles at that time, I'm not sure. But all of a sudden I couldn't get arrested. I lost my apartment in New York. I couldn't pay the rent. Also, I had started being a little bit on the negative side of my being, anyway, hanging out with the wrong people, snorting my cocaine, drinking alcohol, smoking weed. Most of my time was spent doing that, losing lots of money, being very late for all my appointments, blowing jobs, and I knew I had to do something. I've been in California ever since. So it was because of my lifestyle. I needed to change friends, and I needed to change. So I had to flip back into the law business, started temping as a legal secretary and making rock bottom money because I hadn't been in the law business since the 60s. And I continued with that until I got my footing here in California. So I opened my own company and started my own Hanks Legal Services. The real deal is who I am and how I've come about to be who I am. It's so complex, and many times I wish I could sometimes tear myself apart from what I was born into. I wish I was born into wealthy parents. I wish I had the opportunity to go to a prestigious university. My whole life would have been totally different. And believe me, I've torn myself apart with that, wishing I did have another set of parents, another set of circumstances. With that in mind, I know one thing, you are home by yourself when those bills are not paid, and I've been there, and you don't have any food on your table, you have no gas money, and you're counting pennies, that's you. You have no time to think about what people think about you. I do not spend my time trying to build an image. What my choices are my choices, and at the time, sometimes I make some bad choices. And then other times, I get lucky, and whatever happens with your karma, what you think, you attract. I'm so pleased that some actresses have told me, you have no idea how much I've stolen from your work. And I'm so happy to hear that. They've watched my acting and they've taken some things that I've done and they've used it. And people want to think that I've paved the way because each and every one of us, even in our own families, like somebody who started out with a business, that person's to pave the way and that business is continuing and becomes to flourish? Yes, of course I paved the way, as one generation to the next generation does. And that's why we are, as human beings, even living better than being in a cave. Yes, we, all of us, are paving the way.
I just wonder whether you ever watch a new film that's come out and you think, oh yeah, Black Panther, for example, the Marvel movie.
Of course I know. I know I've paved the way, and I know them, all of us from that time period, as they are now, the children today are paving the way for the next generation. We all are paving the way, like the NASA. We all are paving. Before you know it, we're going to have a hotel up there and going up there and spending our time in space, swimming around for a minute. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? But I was paving the way then, because we needed it. Out of necessity, here we go again.
You just got on and did it.
That's what we do, don't we? Don't we? You know, first time this, first time that. And then all of a sudden, you're lost in the heat, and they're gone on. But you know where you came from. And I look at these young people today, and I go, just standing on our shoulders. Then I turn around to the ones I'm standing on, the Lena Horns, the Ethel Waters, and all of those, and et cetera. We're standing on those. But isn't that great? We're all contributing, like the people going to be standing on your shoulders.
I haven't got very big shoulders, Gloria.
It's okay. They found it. They found the space. And who spices up your life? Mwah. And if somebody marries you because you make them laugh and make them happy, you're in trouble. Because nobody makes you happy but yourself.
I really hope you enjoyed that one. Love, Gloria. You've been listening to The Last Bohemians LA, supported by Audio Technica, industry leaders in high-quality audio gear for over 60 years. This episode was recorded by Holly Fisher, edited by Georgie Rogers, and is presented and exec produced by me, Kate Hutchinson. Eternal thank yous to Anders for his patience, and to Peter Cunningham, Ned Pegler, and Cara Dog Jones for contributing the excellent intro music. Check out all the behind-the-scenes photography by Lisa Jelliff at The Last Bohemians Pod on Instagram, and sign up to our Patreon for bonus content. Go on, patreon.com/TheLastBohemians.